They're celebrating Padmasambhava. And it's also the third in our series on what makes a Triratna Buddha land, what are our particular emphases in this community. So we're doing both of those things this evening. So yeah, we're celebrating Padmasambhava, the great teacher who established Buddhism, established the Dharma in Tibet in the 8th century. And I've got this wonderful shrine which Catherine's created for us. Sadly, Catherine's not here at the minute. She might make it back later this evening, but fantastic. This is a sense of the richness of the figure, Padmasambhava. So you can just let those kind of colours and images soak in during the evening as well. We have a special festival for Padmasambhava partly because of the resonances between him and the Triratna Buddhist community, Sangharakshita, our founder. So there's a few of those. One of them is that he is also ecumenical, in a way. Taranita was talking to us a couple of weeks ago about our community being ecumenical. And Padmasambhava, he's got all these different coloured robes. Colours aren't ever so vivid on this particular image, but he wears a red robe, which symbolises the love and compassion of the Mahayana strand of Buddhism, the altruism of that. He's got the yellow robe of a Theravada monk, showing his pure ethical conduct, perfect conduct. And he's got a blue robe. And blue's the colour of the Tantra, the Vajrayana, the type of Buddhism that works with symbol and magic to transform energies. So he's the master of all those different aspects, all those different schools, all those strands of the Dharma. And like Sangharakshita, he's sort of he inherits all of that. He's inspired by all of that. So like us, he's ecumenical. And like Sangharakshita, he took the Dharma to a new culture, a different culture, and needed to meet the energy of that place to establish Buddhism. So in Tibet, Buddhism was opposed by the existing shamanistic religions there, the Bonpo, which were very magical. And so he needed all these magical powers to be able to really meet the kind of energies, the forces of that country. He had a good time converting all the demons of the land to get them on the side of the Dharma. And we're up against different forces in the 21st century here. Our most powerful religions are probably materialism, scientism, consumerism, capitalism, things like that. A whole set of beliefs really, which we often are very influenced by without really questioning. Belief that the material world is dead and we can manipulate it to our benefit, that science can really work out how to do all that and make everything all right and has the answer, the understanding for everything. The belief that we can gain happiness by buying things, and the belief that our economic system is essential, necessary, the way things happen. So lots of those things are in many ways inimical to the Dharma and really need engaging with and transforming. But that's a whole other talk. I'm not going to go into that anymore tonight. But in bringing Buddhism to the West, that's what we're dealing with. Padmasambhava is a very colourful, very rich figure. He's got many aspects, many forms even. He appears in different forms. And amongst those, he really is a very powerful symbol of going for refuge to the three jewels, which is our topic tonight. This is the third of our emphases of the Triratna community that we're looking at, that we see going for refuge to the three jewels as central. And in many ways, I think this is the foundation emphasis. The others are based upon it. And it's one of Sangharakshita's insights, one of his clear understandings about things, that going for refuge to the three jewels is the fundamental act of a Buddhist. It's what makes someone a Buddhist, and it's really the central thing in a Dharma life. So it's about commitment to the values of Buddhism. It's what we have in common with all Buddhists, all different traditions. They all go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. But they don't all clearly know that. They don't all emphasize it or recognize it in the way that we do. It's because we recognize it, because Sangharakshita recognized that, that we're able to be ecumenical. We can really be inspired by the whole range of Buddhism because we can do that critically. We can really look and see what in it is essentially about the values of the Dharma, about going for refuge, and what is a cultural accretion, really, what's just added on because of the circumstances that the Dharma is flowering in. So we can really see, yeah, how it all works. And last week, Taranita was talking to us about how unusual it is in the religious world that we have the same ordination for men and women. But that's also based on this understanding of the central place of going for refuge. It's our commitment to our values that counts, not our gender. It's about how committed you are. We have this one ordination, which is a full-on commitment to the Dharma life, which, again, is very different to most of the Buddhist world. Traditionally, most strands of Buddhism required a monastic lifestyle in order to really go for refuge, really commit to practicing the Dharma. The monks are the real Buddhists in those cultures. We have this phrase, going for refuge is primary and lifestyle is secondary, but not unimportant. Or actually Sangharakshita revised it and said, going for refuge is primary, ethics are secondary, lifestyle is tertiary. So what really does this mean, going for refuge to the three jewels? It's such a piece of Buddhist speak, piece of jargon that we sort of bandy about and get used to using, and we can easily lose sight of its real significance. What is it? A few weeks ago, Karin Varpi glossed it as following your inspiration. I might sometimes talk about it as placing your heart upon the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So those ways of talking are, they say something about it, they're important. We do need to be inspired, we need to be fascinated by the path, by our practice. We need to love the ideals, love the goal, love what it is you think you're trying to do. We need this powerful attraction to the Dharma life if we're really going to get our energies behind what we're doing, what we're trying to do. But in some ways I think those don't really sound strong enough. It sounds a bit sort of nice or something, following your inspiration or placing your heart upon. So it's a bit more than that. It is that and it's more. It's about the response, which we all share, or we wouldn't be here, the response of our whole being to the Dharma, the response of our whole being to recognising that only the three jewels can offer any real freedom from dukkha, from unsatisfactoriness of existence. Recognising that only spiritual values which have a vision of the unlimited potential of human consciousness, values that have a path to follow, a clear way to realise the potential. And values that are about sharing that with others through Sangha. Only those can ultimately really satisfy the human heart and mind fully. Everything else is just too limited, too small, whatever else you might really want to follow. So, yeah, it's about the response of our whole being to the three jewels, to values, to reality. Response of our hearts, minds, energies, volitions, will, just everything. Everything that wants to go towards what's really precious, really important in life. We very, very often in Sri Ratna talk about going for refuge as commitment. So we talk about our commitment to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. And that does come closer. And commitment has this sense of wholeheartedness, of doing something, the going of going for refuge. So it's our commitment to deepening that response that we share. We all have a, a, sort of response to those values. And it's a commitment to really deepening that, deepening our understanding of what that means, what the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha really, really are about. It's a commitment to becoming a Buddha by realising the flow of life for ourselves, really being able to live in accord with that, and a commitment to creating Sangha, sharing that with others. And it's a gradual thing. You can't just suddenly turn the whole of your being in a different direction than you might have been going in. It's not all at once. It's like turning a great ocean liner or something. It's a sort of gradual edging yourself round. But the more you do it, the more you see what you can do. You see what's possible, you see what's involved, you see what it is you need to do. It's like as the ocean liner turns, the view changes and it becomes more and more possible to get its energies there. So yeah, it's about commitment, it's about clarity, clear seeing, and it's about choice. It's about knowing what's important to you, what's really most important in your life, knowing what your heart longs for, and choosing to base your life around that. So to come back to Padmasambhava, I'm going to illustrate going for refuge with a story from Padmasambhava's extraordinary biography, which is in two volumes. It's a completely mad text. It's completely full of all sorts of magical and exotic happenings, and it's works on all kinds of different levels. But I'm just going to tell you a story from there: The Life and Liberation of Padmasambhava, Part 2. So you've probably heard the story that the King of Tibet decided he wanted to establish Buddhism. He wanted to get Buddhism into his country and had some difficulty with that. He invited a learned Buddhist scholar, a very accomplished practitioner, a very kind man, to come and set things up. But the local spirits and demons just weren't having any of it. So the story goes that they're trying to build a monastery, and every night the demons would take it all apart again, hurl all the rocks, all the work, back into the mountains, and they were sort of starting from scratch every day. So this is kind of what they were up against with the forces of Tibet in the 8th century. So the king's advised to call on Padmasambhava, this really accomplished practitioner. He is also a great scholar, but he's also got magical psychic powers from the depth of his tantric meditation. So he calls on him to come from India, and Padmasambhava goes and has all sorts of adventures along the way, which are in book one, including demon taming. He wins over all sorts of powerful forces and gets them on side with supporting the growth of the Dharma. And eventually he arrived in Lhasa in Tibet, where the king was. And the king's there, he's staying in a pleasure park on the riverbank. And he's there in a double castle, apparently, by the side of the river. And he's there with his two queens and his whole entourage. So there's all the ministers and the courtiers and everybody else. The king sent two ambassadors to meet Padmasambhava with 500 ironclad horsemen. So you can imagine this sea of riders in their shining armour going out to greet this visitor who's been invited. And they escort Padmasambhava back to meet the king. So Padmasambhava walks into this party, really. The king's there with his queens, courtiers, ministers, the queen's ladies, and they're all dressed in the finest silks, shimmering silks, all iridescent, multicoloured silks. It says they're like the quivering radiance of a brood of pigeons. I suppose it's that lovely iridescent purpley-green bit on the pigeon. They've got this sort of shimmering iridescence to them. And they've obviously put on a good party because there's a description of the different kinds of dances and music that are going on. So they're obviously, this is all the big welcome event for Padmasambhava. So he walks into this whole scenario and spots the king. And then obviously he knows what you're supposed to do at that point is bow to the king, to greet, acknowledge what you're walking into. That would be customary. But Padmasambhava is radically unconventional, and so he doesn't immediately bow. And there's this awkward pause while he thinks. And what he thinks to himself is, who are we, he and I? Plunged in darkness is his mind. I am learned in the five realms of wisdom. Buddha in a single lifetime, exempt from birth and death. It is out of necessity that he invites me here. Formerly this king bowed down before me. Shall I or shall I not return his bow? If yes, the majesty of the Dharma will be slighted. If no, since he is the king, he will be angered. Yet, however great he be, bow down I cannot. So the king starts to get annoyed, and he's thinking, I am the sovereign over all the black heads of Tibet. The Bodhisattva abbot has already made obeisance to me. This guru must prostrate himself as well. So the king wasn't going to make the first move. He wasn't going to greet Padmasambhava. So this awkward pause continues. And then Padmasambhava responded in song. So I don't know the tune, even if I were brave enough to sing to you. And it's very, very long, so I'll read you part of it. There's about 28 or 29 verses, and I've probably done about a dozen of them. So he says, I am Padmasambhava, the holy Dharma. Mine are the teachings for assured ascension in the Dharma. Externally, I am a saffron-robed monk. Within, the yogi of the supreme secret mantras. I am Padmasambhava, the monk. Mine are the teachings of the interpenetration of theory and practice of the scriptures. An intuitive wisdom vaster than the sky. My conduct as fine as the grains of flour. I am Padmasambhava of lofty meditation. Mine are the teachings on contemplating the Dharma outside the time of meditation. In the wheel of samsara and nirvana, there is no accepting or rejecting. I am Padmasambhava, the doctor. Mine is the nectar of the Dharma, the teachings that cure one of death. I am Padmasambhava, the sorcerer. Mine are the teachings of the Dharma that transmute the five poisonous mental states. I do not bid farewell to pleasures. I take them with me on the path. I exult in the wisdom of the five Buddhas. I am Padmasambhava, the king. Mine are the teachings of the Dharma, possessing authority in the three realms. I embrace and shake the profound cycle of conditions. I accomplish every action, subjugating the mind itself. I am Padmasambhava, the Lord. Mine are the teachings of the Dharma that scrutinizes and pronounces upon error. With the Bodhisattva's compassion as a blade, I have slaughtered inimical wrong views and misconceptions. I am Padmasambhava, the hero. Mine are the teachings of the Dharma that trample underfoot the hostile wheel of life. Having assigned the heritage of these gifts, I establish my fortunate children in the Dharma. I am Padmasambhava, the youth. Mine are the teachings of both relative and absolute meaning of the Dharma. I storm the fortress of the threefold ecstasy. In places of every kind I like to play. I am Padmasambhava, the deathless. Mine are the teachings for the diamond life of the Dharma. I am not dependent upon the four external elements, nor do I set up a dwelling for the internal body of flesh and blood. And you, king of barbarian Tibet, king of the country without virtue, uncouth men and ogres surround you. You rely upon famine's serfs, and neither joy nor good humour are yours. As for your queens, they are demons in human shape. Beautiful purple spirits surround them. Sandalwood, turquoise, and gold adorn them. But they have no hearts and no minds. You are king, your lungs swell, great is your power, your liver is well satisfied. Sceptre in hand and haughty you stand high, but I, sire, will not bow down before you. And yet, in accordance with my conjoined vows, having come to the heart of Tibet, here I stay. Great king, witness, have I come? So he sings this song, and as he does that, or as he gets to the end of it, he turns his hand, and springing from his finger, a miraculous flame springs out and sears the king's garments. I kind of imagine them across the crowd. There's this a magic flame that burns the king's garments, singes them all. And then the whole assembly, as one body, prostrates before him. It says, as though swept by a scythe. I love that image, like a scythe through a sheath of corn or something, just tumbling down by Padmasambhava's presence and his words, his song. So what is going on here? What's this really about? It's like a great showdown, isn't it? It's sort of, who's the best? So you could read it like a, you know, who's best, who's, I'm better than you kind of showdown. And Padmasambhava really is quite a character. Like all the stories, it's like he's just so full a character. Frisky, someone was saying earlier, which is another word. But in this story, it's just really striking to me how completely free of false modesty he is. He just hasn't got that inverted sort of like, well, I suppose I'm quite, maybe I'm not as good as you kind of thing going on at all. He's just really, really able to take his space, take his significance. And I'm sure he's not actually falling into the other side of pride either. I'm sure he's not arrogant. I don't think that's what his song is about. I think he's the perfection of what Sangharakshita calls the true individual. So he's not going to just conform to the customs of the group he finds himself in, this society, this gathering, just for the sake of it. He's not going to be polite just to please people. He knows the king will be angry, and he's not frightened of that. He's not, you know, that's not a deciding factor for him. I'm sure he's not being deliberately rude either, and nor should we be. I think we could do with being more courteous, more aware of each other, more hospitable to each other, more helpful to each other. He's not going against convention in a rebellious way, not just to prove that he's above it all or something, not just to show he's free of that, all that conventional stuff. Because that would still be being defined by the conventional stuff. If he's doing the opposite just to prove a point, then he's still, you know, controlled. He's not really free. Something else is going on with Padmasambhava, and I'll come back to it. One way to think about it is that he's not saying I'm better, he's saying the Dharma is better. So it isn't all about Padmasambhava and his ego. It's about the energy of the Dharma, which is sort of coursing through him, his ability to really transmit the Dharma. And that's what he's saying is precious and important and most worthy of respect. He's saying the Dharma life is better. It's more satisfying, more ecstatic than the life of riches and power that the king lives by. He's saying the Dharma is the only refuge from mind-made suffering and fear of sickness, old age and death. So he's just really sticking up for what he knows of that, sticking up for his values rather than the values of the king. So that's one way to think about it, and that is what he's saying, and that's certainly how our choices to go for refuge often look. Certainly for a very long time on the path, we do need to make choices. We need to know our values and choose to live by what's most important to us. And that sometimes involves not doing or not having something else we thought we wanted. You know, just you all know on that very sort of day-to-day level. If it's important to me to get up tomorrow morning and meditate before my mid-morning meeting, then it would be not a good idea to go back, have two glasses of wine and watch a film till one in the morning. There's, you know, we make choices all the time about how we're living according to what's really important to us. So he's kind of implying all of that sort of thing in a way. But I think it's in a way something else again, or something more as well. Padmasambhava is acting completely outside the whole frame of reference that the king is operating in. Padmasambhava is fully enlightened. He comes from a different level of consciousness altogether, a much, much bigger perspective. He's got a whole different viewpoint on life, a different paradigm or world view of everything. So he just isn't in that competition of who's the best, who's the richest, who's the most powerful. He's just not taking part in that at all. And the king is really, really in that. So to talk about this paradigm that the king's in, the sort of way the king's thinking about things, I'm just going to introduce another teaching from the Buddha on the worldly winds. So the Buddha said there are 8 worldly conditions which spin after the world, and the world spins after these 8 worldly conditions. So we usually translate conditions as winds. We call them poetically the worldly winds. So they're the forces of the world, the forces that the world operates on. And I like this spinning, this spin after the world. It's like a whirlwind of perpetual motion. The winds blowing through the world being blown by, created by these winds, and winds blowing in the wake of the world as it spins in the reactive, vicious cycle that the world operates in. So these 8 are, the Buddha lists, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, and fame and infamy, or status and disgrace, I think makes a bit more sense. See that behind me, but anyway. So we have these four pairs, as a, you know, upside and a downside. And the Buddha says these happen to everyone. These winds are blowing about all the time, changing like the weather. We can't control them, and it happens to us all. So yeah, sets of opposites. And there's one set that we want. We want pleasure, gain, praise and status. And one set that we don't want. We don't want pain, loss, blame and disgrace. And the king at the moment is all over here, isn't he? He's got all the upsides. He's got a lot of power, status. Presumably he gets praised. He's gained a lot. He's got a lot of pleasure. He's got all these riches, everything. But the trouble is, as the Buddha goes on to point out, pleasure, gain, praise and status are inconstant, stressful and subject to change. And, the Buddha says, our minds become consumed with forces which we can't control. We get obsessed with these, with trying to line ourselves up on this side and avoid the things we don't want. And that's what causes our suffering, our stress, because we welcome, the Buddha says, we welcome these and we rebel against these. So we fight against the painful stuff, and that's really what causes us all the stress. And we can sense that with the king. We can sense the way, for all the advantages of his position, his 500 ironclad horsemen, all that power, all his wives, all these ministers and courtiers, the horses, the silks, the jewels, the turquoise, the sandalwood, the gold, all the rest, it's still a kind of defensive position. All those things are ultimately inconstant, subject to change, and the king is very identified with them. He's obsessed with them. It's like his ego needs all that for him to keep being a someone, and that's what matters to him. He needs all those armoured men, all the riches. And it takes a lot of energy and worry to keep it all up. It's stressful having all that you might lose. And he's bothered whether people bow to him. It really matters. So the king represents, he's almost like a symbol of what Subhuti, one of our senior order members, calls our fragile ego surrounded by a sea of threat. This is what we all are. We've all got a fragile ego surrounded by a sea of threat. We all do this. And our attempts to manage that is what causes our dukkha, our pain, our distress in life. Our attempts to keep on this side and out of this side causes all the tension, all the stress. And when Padmasambhava steps into this world, he just refuses to buy into it at all. He's just not buying into the king's world, the king's values there. So it's not that he's saying, I've got more pleasure and more status than you, though from one perspective he has. It's not that he's saying the Dharma is better at keeping the winds of pain and disgrace, etc., at bay, because it isn't. The Buddha in this sutta about the worldly winds makes it clear that these winds blow on everyone. Whether you're practicing or not, you're still subject to these things happening. It's how you respond is what frees you. What you do with your mind in relation to that is what frees you. So Padmasambhava is just stepping out of that whole frame of reference, that paradigm, altogether. He's aware of it. He knows what's expected, that he's supposed to bow. He knows the king will be angry, but he's not defined by those rules, those values. He's deeply, radically unconventional. He's wild of mind. He's not rebellious, not in a rebellious way. He's just living in this total freedom from being defined and limited by any of those structures and ideas. He's operating in a different mode altogether. He's not caught up with the sort of thoughts and stories that go with our obsessive fight to keep things pleasurable and blame the world for all the painful things. So what does this mean for us? What's it like to step out of the fight to get the worldly winds to blow the way we want them to? I'll tell you one of several stories I could think of my own. So there was a time, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, when I was a dentist and I owned the dental practice I worked in, and I'd fallen out with my business partner there, the person I shared the premises with. And it just seemed that we couldn't work together anymore. One of us had got to go. And I hated her. I just really wanted her out. It's just like, this is my place and I don't want you here. I want her to leave so I could carry on and run my business my way, the way I wanted to. And this had been sort of deadlocked for a while. And yeah, I was unhappy and I was all set for a legal battle. I was going to force her out if I could. I'd taken advice and we were going to see, you know, what was possible to actually get her to leave so I could get on and do what I wanted to. Then I was on a weekend retreat for order members and I heard these verses of the Dhammapada. Happy indeed we live, friendly amid the haters. Among men who hate, we dwell free from hate. Happy indeed we live, content amid the greedy. Among people who are greedy, we dwell free from greed. Victory begets hatred, for the defeated one experiences suffering. The tranquil one experiences happiness, giving up both victory and defeat. And it was like, oh, wrong mindset, Jwalamalini. Yeah, wrong paradigm. Something, yeah, that is true, isn't it? And I'm doing something else and this isn't in line with my going for refuge. And there was this tussle. It wasn't like an instant letting go. It went on for quite a while longer. A lot of like, yes, but she shouldn't, I should. And, you know, but somewhere that had just lodged in me, I'd gone, oh, yes. The victory isn't a victory to win. This isn't a thing to do. And just asking, what effect will this battle have on me, whether I win or I lose? What price victory, really? What's that going to mean? What karma is that setting up? Eventually, I was able to just let go of that battle. And in doing that, it made the space to let my deeper heart wishes come through, to realise that actually I'd had enough of running that business anyway. It had served me well, and it was time to move on. I wanted actually to find ways to put my energy more behind my Dharma practice and being able to share the Dharma more. I'd learnt a lot from running that business, and it was time for a different challenge, different set of things to do. So, yeah, it was like stepping out of that polarity, that battle of win-lose, succeed-gain, and just letting something else emerge. And we can all practice with this all the time in all sorts of small ways. I really recommend this book by Vajragupta, Sailing the Worldly Winds. He goes into all sorts of helpful everyday ways of practicing with these winds. And the one I particularly like, because it gives this sense of stepping out of the battle, stepping out of the polarity into a different paradigm, different set of values, different ways of seeing things. He calls seeing the winds as opportunities. So he identifies a way to practice with each pair of opposites, which just allows us to step out of the battle, the fight with the wind, the fight with the weather, the gales of life altogether. The one I think makes it clearest is working with gain and loss, so here, with generosity. So if you decide to practice generosity, if generosity is your mission, then it totally changes the rules of the game. Everything turns from what can I get to what can I give. You just step out completely from the whole who's getting most kind of system. So you move from this system where you might win or lose, you might get or you might not get, to something which is really win-win. If you're trying to give, you can give. Simple. Vajragupta uses the example of driving in traffic and how our competitiveness and our pride can kick in, and we're always sort of, you know, trying to get in front and, you know, be there first or whatever it is. And how different it is if you just try to drive generously. So you're looking for opportunities to let people in front of you in traffic and things like that. And what a different state of mind you get to your destination in. It's sort of, you know, it's very everyday. We can all do that. But it's that sort of stepping outside of the what can I get mentality. The others, which I won't go into all of, are mindfulness. For working with pleasure and pain. Praise and blame, he says. If you get more concerned with the truth rather than what people think, truthfulness. Again, you can kind of step out of your ego, and if someone criticises you, just really say, is that true? And it might be, and it might not be. And for status and disgrace, fame and infamy, which is really the main thing that Padmasambhava and the king are dealing with, he says it's individuality. So as I said earlier, I do think Padmasambhava is the perfect true individual, and he is just stepping out of the whole framework of status versus disgrace. In refusing to make obeisances to the king, he's just stepping out of that. So praise and blame by the group, that's what status and disgrace are about really, by the tribe, whether you conform or you rebel, or whether instead of either of those you just act with integrity and wholeness and individuality, true integrity to your values. So Padmasambhava isn't claiming higher status, he's valuing dharmic values, expressing his individuality, the integrity of who he is, really imbued with the Dharma. And this stepping out of the frame of reference of the worldly winds again and again is another way of looking at going for refuge to the three jewels. Again and again we can notice how we get obsessed with trying to obtain pleasure, gain, praise and status, and avoid pain, loss, blame and disgrace. And just really look at what's going on in our minds. Look at what stories we tell ourselves about all that. We can notice what's really happening, how it changes, what else is in our experience. Because it's always mixed, actually. We might think it's all pleasure or it's all pain, but there's usually something of both. And in that way, we loosen our belief in our stories. And that makes the space, the gap, for a less habitual, less automatic response, for something creative to come through, something more aligned with what's truly important to us. Doing that in this way, it's like we become artists creating ourselves and our lives. We become more and more skilled at our art the longer we practice, more and more clear what it is we're creating, who we're becoming. We can use the Buddha or Padmasambhava or Tara or whatever for you expresses the ultimate potential of human consciousness for us. We can use that as like a blueprint for our creativity to inspire us to change. We can use the Buddha's advice, the methods he suggested for us to do that. And we can form a creative community together, growing through helping each other, inspiring each other, learning from each other. As we integrate our energies around what's important to us, we become bigger, richer, more aspects of ourselves get on board with our artwork that we're doing. So like Padmasambhava, we can contain a monk, a king, a child, a youth, a hero, a sorcerer, and more. And all of those can serve the Dharma, serve our quest for truth, generosity, love, whatever. Doing that, our obsessions with the worldly wind decrease, they loosen, so that we can align ourselves more and more with reality. We can become more and more creative, more and more able to go for refuge, more and more deeply, till, like Padmasambhava, we're really free, undefined by worldly conventions, values and aims, just totally appropriately responsive to what each moment brings.